the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. One of the most hotly debated topics in American history concerns what human civilization looked like before Columbus's arrival in the Western Hemisphere. Those on one end of the debate subscribe to a picture of the pre-Columbian world as more or less Edenic. Others take issue with this view, labeling it as the pristine myth, and instead point to evidence that Native Americans manipulated their environment, not always in a positive way. Our guest this week, Charles Mann, weighs in on the topic with the latest evidence he included in his book on the subject, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Mann will be speaking with Talking History's John Herron. Following that, Fiona Beattie will tell us about a site where you can learn more about the natural history of America, and Michael Farquhar returns with another segment in his special series drawn from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at some items of historical interest in the news. This week, as we draw near the end of another calendar year, we thought we would call to your attention two items in the news tied to 2005, both addressing anniversaries. The first is a follow-up on the show we aired earlier this year, the week of April 18th, to be exact, in case you want to go to our archive and listen to the show again, on the Annus Mirabilis, the centennial year of wonders, 1905, when Einstein burst onto the scene with three major scientific publications that transformed the world of physics. The Associated Press recently reported that the original manuscript of a paper Einstein published in 1925, Quantum Theory of the Monatomic Ideal of Gas, which is considered one of Einstein's last great scientific breakthroughs, has been found in the archives of Leiden University. And in an article that appeared in the November issue of Physics Today, Steven Weinberg paid homage to the greatest physicist of the 20th century by reminding us of Einstein's mistakes and what we can learn from those errors. By way of example, Weinberg points to what Einstein himself considered to be his biggest blunder, his cosmological constant. Weinberg explains that Einstein created the constant to help explain his general theory of relativity because he accepted the then widely accepted idea that the universe was static, which was soon to be proven incorrect. The second mistake Weinberg points to is Einstein's resistance to the new field of quantum mechanics, which, Weinberg argues, led to his isolation from other researchers in physics from the 1930s to his death in 1955. And what can we learn from those mistakes? Weinberg suggests that by recognizing Einstein's errors, we set a good example for those who follow other supposed paths to truth. We recognize that our most important scientific forerunners were not prophets whose writings must be studied as infallible guides. They were simply great men and women who prepared the ground for the better understandings we have now achieved. The second anniversary in the news, one that we did not cover on this show this year, but that seems appropriate to recall in this year of natural disasters, was that of the Lisbon earthquake. In November, Portugal marked the 250 years since the devastating earthquake and tsunami that killed thousands of people and flattened the city of Lisbon. Up to one-third of the city's inhabitants, 275,000 people, died in the disaster, with thousands more dead in Morocco, Spain, and even Italy. Church bells rang out at 9:30 GMT on November 1st, the estimated time that the earthquake struck in 1755. Scientists estimate that the quake would have measured 8.5 on the modern Richter scale. When we return, John Herron explores the Americas in 1491 with his guest, Charles Mann. This is Talking History. As one writer recently put it, If one were to summarize several centuries of academic thinking about what the Americas looked like before Columbus arrived, it might sound something like this. There weren't that many Indians. The Indians who did live in the Americas weren't natives. They'd come in the back door from somewhere else. They hadn't been here long before Columbus arrived, and anyway, they didn't do much with the place. Just how accurate this long-standing assessment is the subject of John Herron's conversation this week with Charles Mann.
As every grade school child knows, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But what few of these children know, indeed what few Americans of any age know, is the size and complexity of the cultures Columbus encountered. Tradition has long marked native peoples as primitive, even backward. But as our guest this week illustrates, the native world of the pre-contact Americas was in fact rich in culture and sophistication. He is Charles Mann, correspondent for Science and the Atlantic Monthly. Among his previous works are Noah's Choice, The Future of Endangered Species, and The Second Creation. His latest book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, was published in 2005 by Alfred Knopf. Welcome, Charles.
Glad to be here.
With this project, you are certainly wading into very controversial waters. What human civilizations might have looked like before European arrival is still very much debated. Give us a little bit of the background. What questions brought you to this project?
Well, it was kind of random, actually, at the beginning. I'm a correspondent for Science, as you said, and I was asked by the journal to cover an expedition that was measuring atmospheric ozone levels in the early 1980s. And they landed in Yucatan, in the Yucatan Peninsula. Everybody had a day off for some reason, and we went and looked at the Maya ruins. And I had previously lived in Italy for a couple of years, and I was completely surprised by the size, scale, sophistication, aesthetic interest. In every way, I was totally bowled over by what I saw. Basically, I thought, why didn't I learn about this in school? So over the years, from time to time, I would try to arrange some kind of reporting assignment that would take me to various Native American sites, and I would use the journalist's privilege to call up people randomly and ask them about it. And I gradually learned that the way that researchers in the field, archaeologists, geographers, anthropologists, and so on, thought about these societies was totally different from what I had learned in school. And then when my son went to high school in the 1990s, I realized he was learning basically what I had learned, and that this view was outdated by decades. And I thought, you know, somebody should write a book.
Right. Well, I mentioned that this topic is very controversial, but why so controversial? What do you believe is at stake in this debate about what human civilizations would have looked like before Columbus arrived?
Well, in addition to the intellectual stakes, because after all, we're dealing with the history of half of the world over a period of 15,000 years, which is, I think, of obvious interest in and of itself, there's some direct political implications that people draw from this. And they displease some on the right and some on the left. On the right, there is a feeling that if you give these non-Western societies that were here before Europeans a certain view of them as very complicated, then this is an attempt to make European society look bad for going in there and to up the guilt quotient. And there's a resistance on this, and it's sometimes derided as, oh, you're politically correct, these people were actually barbarians, cannibals, and, you know, some words like this have been thrown in my general direction. On the left, there's a feeling that if these societies were very large, that increases the estimate necessarily of the environmental impact that they had, which in turn suggests that the Americas were not a pristine wilderness, and that therefore this means that you're kind of opening the door for developers to come in and say, well, look, this wasn't a beautiful place before, these weren't eco-friendly, let's pave the entire hemisphere.
Well, building on that question, you refer often in your text to the pristine myth in your description of what native cultures may have been looked like. Could you explain the background for the pristine myth?
Yeah, the term was coined, I believe, by the geographer William Denovan of the University of Wisconsin. And it refers to the idea, which is something that certainly I was taught in high school when I went, that Indians lived, for the most part, in small scattered bands and had so little impact on the environment that the hemisphere, when Columbus landed, was, for all intents and purposes, a wilderness, a place unmarked by the human touch. And a whole generation of researchers has looked into this question, and they believe, Benevin sort of foremost among them, that the Americas were, in fact, thoroughly painted by the human brush. And for us to have this view, which they call the pristine myth, is to make a profound historical mistake about the conditions that were here before Columbus.
Well, there's also a counter-mythology to that notion that portrays Indians not as pristine, but as aggressive killers. In fact, I think you mentioned over-killers of large game and maybe to a lesser extent each other. You argue that that theory is as misleading as the pristine myth, correct?
Yeah, there's this idea, and this one has given some comfort to, you know, a certain strain of conservative thought called overkill, Pleistocene overkill. And the idea is that when Indians came across the Bering Straits, they came to North America. There was two continents full of game animals that had never seen human beings, and it was kind of like two continents full of breakfast. And the Indians radiated out from the north to the south, slaughtering as they went. The end result was that 32 genera, 32 genuses of animals went extinct in a relatively short period of time. Now, those extinctions did happen. And scientists have cut down entire forests to print the journal articles arguing about why they existed. The difficulty with the overkill theory is that in recent decades, evidence has mounted that Native Americans were here longer than previously thought. And if they were here for 25,000 years, as a lot of the genetic evidence suggests, and so does the linguistic evidence, then they would have been here for 10,000 years and then suddenly exterminated all these animals. And it's puzzling to figure out why that would have been the case. There's other evidence against the overkill theory as well, but that seems to me a particularly difficult roadblock for it.
Well, with some of that information in mind, some of that background, let's turn to the specifics of your story. And again, I realize that these questions are probably much debated, but is there an accepted estimate to the size of the pre-Columbian population?
Well, in the early 1960s, the generally accepted estimate for population in North America is about 900,000, and in the Americas as a whole, a few million. Now, I think you would say today that a relatively conservative estimate would be on the order of 30 or 40 million. In fact, just last week I saw an estimate of 200 million. This is for the entire hemisphere, I'm sorry. So in a kind of crude, split-the-difference sort of way, you might say something on the order of 80 to 100 million would be the midway in those extremes. And the striking thing is that this is roughly equivalent to the population of Europe at the time.
Right.
Now, these numbers are very loose and baggy, including the population in Europe. But the important point is that there are tens of millions of people here, and I think there's very little disagreement about that. And societies with tens of millions of people, that's a very different thing than when you have a couple million people.
And lots of these people were living in lots of urban centers.
Right. A city like Tenochtitlan, which was the capital of what's been called the Aztec Empire, which is really an alliance of three different groups, and it was the largest city in the empire of those three groups. Anyway, Tenochtitlan, the Mexican capital, had an estimated population of about 250,000. And in 1500, this is a very large place. It's larger than Paris or London, for example.
Right. How do we now believe that all these people got here?
Well, this is an area in which there's a great deal of confusion. It used to be that there was this kind of consensus view that's sometimes called the Clovis First view. And the idea is that, to rehearse it very briefly, when there's the Ice Age, there's these enormous ice sheets, two of them, that covered North America. And so much water went into them that they drew it from the sea, and the sea level dropped ultimately about 300 feet. Very shallow areas of the sea were thus exposed, including the shallow area between Siberia and Alaska, which became a broad land bridge. It's called Beringia. Now, there's a second part to this theory that is rarely told to high school people, and certainly wasn't told to me, which is that if they walked across Beringia, which was fairly habitable because it was warmed up by the Japanese current, they would have immediately hit these ice sheets. They would have hit 2,500 miles of ice. And the question would be, well, why would they cross it? You know, even today, you would need specialized equipment to do something like that. It would be the subject of a National Geographic special. Mm-hmm. And the idea is there was this kind of magic moment in which the ice started melting, and Beringia wasn't completely covered up yet. You know, the sea was rising, and the ice melted enough for the two ice sheets to peel back, a little bit like Moses in the Red Sea, and people could scoot across the Bering Straits and then dodge through this ice-free corridor that opened up. Meanwhile, game from the south would have traveled up this corridor to provide some food to eat, and people have jokingly called this the follow the reindeer theory. Mm-hmm. People followed the reindeer down to North America. Unfortunately, evidence has been piling up against this and challenging this. It's called the Clovis theory because the culture that appears in the archaeological record at this time is known as the Clovis culture, after the town in New Mexico where the first important site of this culture was found. And the evidence is from a variety of genetic, linguistic, and archaeological sources has suggested that this doesn't work. The most impressive to me on a personal level is the geological evidence suggesting that this ice-free corridor didn't exist. And if that's the case, then it's very hard to explain how they would have walked across, and you start almost by default looking to boats. it is true that Australia was populated very early by people on boats, and that's how people got there. So you can start saying, well, maybe they went across from Siberia on boats. And at that point, you don't need the Bering Land Bridge, because if they can go by boats to Australia, they can cross this very narrow passage between them. And the result has been to, I think, of all this evidence, been to discredit or severely hurt the credibility of this earlier theory without coming up with evidence for an alternative paradigm. So there's a state of confusion at the moment.
So we have much larger numbers of people than we once believed, living in much larger urban centers than we once believed. And these societies that you detail in your book were also very highly regulated, very structured. I mean, you mentioned inventing forms of government and means of counting and timekeeping. Were you amazed or startled at the level of sophistication of some of these pre-Columbian cultures?
Yeah, partly because, as a layperson, I tend to have exaggerated ideas about the sophistication of European society at the time. For instance, it's generally believed that the Olmec invented zero sometime prior to the birth of Christ, perhaps 6 or 7 centuries prior to the birth of Christ. Zero, most mathematicians would tell you, is the most important discovery ever in mathematics. It simply permits all kinds of calculations to occur, as anyone knows who's ever tried to calculate with Roman numerals. In the 15th century A.D., the religious establishment of the Vatican was attempting to restrict the use of zero in Europe. It was regarded as a dangerous foreign invention, and there's numerous accounts of business people essentially keeping 2 accounting records, one in the appropriate Roman numerals and then a secret one in which they would use zero. So personally, I wasn't at all surprised that native societies had zero. What surprised me was learning that the Europeans didn't. So I was continually brought up by this, short by this. The worst way to put it, I would think, would be that these societies were in many ways as sophisticated as European societies, but the way that they were sophisticated was entirely different, so that they had very complicated and sophisticated technologies of all sorts, but they were very much unlike European technologies. Their metallurgy was used for completely different ends than European metallurgy, for example.
Well, native peoples also manipulated the physical environment. That the natural world of, say, 1491 was different from 1691 seems obvious, but it was different in ways that contemporary observers would not expect. The primeval forest that 19th century Americans, for example, celebrated as real nature was a relatively modern invention, right?
Yeah. Again, what we're taught in school is that Europeans came and laid waste to the wilderness. In the most dreadful and ironic way, the opposite is true. What happened is that Europeans came in and brought with them European diseases, which for a whole complex series of reasons, native populations had no experience with. These diseases radiated throughout the continent, causing just enormous death rates. And I think most researchers in the field would argue that something on the order of 90% of the Native American population died between about 1500 and about 1650. Now, different people would argue with that, but that gives you some idea of the enormous scale of the catastrophe. And what happened is that these large societies had been manipulating and managing nature for their own ends, as societies everywhere in the world do. And when the continent was depopulated, the people who had their hands on the steering wheel were removed. And this happened ahead of Europeans coming into many parts of the Americas. The result was that Europeans inadvertently, and in the most tragic way possible, created wilderness. You know, they came into areas that had recently become wild because people weren't there anymore.
Well, that was just one of many examples you cite. Another one is that the Amazonian jungle, for example, now seems kind of timeless, when in fact you point to archaeological and ecological evidence that suggests that this too is a very human place.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those areas in which there's a whole bunch of arrows that are all pointing in the same direction. It's not like you come across something that's like the equivalent of the smoking gun for this. But there's ecological, genetic, historical records that there are large-scale societies through the Amazon, you know, all along the river when Columbus landed. And the way these societies farmed was a very different way than European farming. And so its secrets weren't unraveled until quite recently. In fact, this is a real area of ongoing research. Basic idea is that the soils in tropical forest are notoriously poor and can't sustain large-scale agriculture. And what Amazonian cultures did was to transform the soils through creating what is called a terra preta, or Amazonian dark earths. And they were in the process of terraforming the Amazon, so to speak, creating these large areas with rich, fertile soils when Columbus came and European diseases wiped out these efforts.
Well, what has been the response to your work?
People have been basically very kind to it, so I feel quite lucky. You know, there's a certain number of people on the political right and the political left who have complained about it. And sometimes historians have complained. By and large, historians are separated from archaeologists and anthropologists and geographers by these very high disciplinary boundaries. And they don't know what their colleagues in the next offices are finding. And most of the historians who have spoken to me have been happy to find out from a journalistic account what those guys are doing. But some have sort of indignantly denied this. And particularly a focus of unhappiness has been when I try to talk about what kind of enduring influences Native American cultures could have had on our own societies today. And there seems to be, at least among some historians, a general feeling that this is ridiculous, that Native societies couldn't have had any influence. And that seems to me, I find that difficult to imagine. We lived cheek by jowl with Native societies for centuries. They're very important from 1500 to 1800 to everyday Americans, both North and in the South. And the idea that this three-century-long association wouldn't have had an impact, I find hard to swallow. But that's what historical argument is about.
Right. Well, thank you, Charles. I hope you will join us again soon.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charles Mann, author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, published by Alfred Knopf. This is Talking History.
The topic of our interview this week might be put in the category of natural history, so we thought we might offer you, as our site of the week, a place where you can go to learn more about the fascinating world of natural history. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Fiona Beattie.
The Smithsonian Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. presents the history of humankind and animals through the disciplines of geology, biology, and anthropology. Its three floors house collections of rocks, fossils, insects, bones, and human artifacts, an IMAX theater, interactive computers, animated graphics, and multimedia presentations. Highlights in the fossil collection include a 3.5 billion-year-old stromatolite, a blue-green algae clump, one of the earliest signs of life on Earth, and a 70-million-year-old dinosaur egg. The collection of rocks, gems, and minerals include the legendary Hope Diamond. The museum's website provides information on present and future exhibits, as well as online exhibits, such as the Lakota Winter Counts, complete with digitized images of actual documents, an overview of Lakota custom, a documentary on Lakota history and culture, videos of interviews with Lakota people, and a teacher's guide. The site's searchable database provides extensive information on research, the collections, bibliography, and reference databases. To find out more about the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, go to www.mnh.si.edu.
And finally, we continue our series of segments drawn from Michael Farquhar's new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. This week, Farquhar, a writer and editor for The Washington Post, has selected a tale told in Part 5 of his book, Science Fictions, on Piltdown Man.
In 1913, amateur archaeologist Charles Dawson uncovered what many scientists believe was the pivotal figure in man's evolution from ape. There wasn't much to Piltdown Man, popularly named for the site in southern England where he was found. just a few skull fragments and a portion of jaw that appeared remarkably simian. But Piltdown Man was a sensation, perhaps the most famous Englishman of his day. People made pilgrimages to the site where he was found, and scores of scholarly books and papers were devoted to what appeared to be the most important discovery in the relatively new field of human paleontology. Any doubts as to the authenticity of the find were effectively silenced when Charles Dawson uncovered more bone fragments from a site he said was a couple of miles away from the original discovery. Piltdown Man was thus firmly established as the first true missing link, and it would take another 4 decades until he was exposed as one of the greatest of all scientific frauds. Joseph Weiner began an investigation in the early 1950s. He found that Piltdown Man was nothing more than a clumsy concoction made from the skull of a medieval Englishman and the jawbone of an orangutan. This was no merry prank that had been pulled 4 decades earlier. One scientist called it the most troubled chapter in the study of man's origins that set back for years the search for understanding. So who was the maniacal schemer behind it all? A variety of suspects has been put forth over the years. One theory holds that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was the man behind the hoax. He had motive and opportunity. Doyle lived close to the Piltdown site and had plenty of access to fossils. He also held a grudge against scientists who mocked his interest in spiritualism and would have been happy to make fools of them. A more likely culprit, however, is Charles Dawson, who originally discovered Piltdown Man. He was fiercely ambitious and desperate to make a name for himself among the scientific elite. He was also responsible for a number of other scientific frauds, some of them quite successful. If Dawson was indeed responsible for the hoax, it was by far his greatest success. It's ironic, then, that the man so eager for recognition has never been given official credit for the scheme, and that, it seems, is the most appropriate punishment.
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar reading from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. That's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need to do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.